Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Wow, we bounce from the west coast of Ireland to the west coast of New England and then on to Brattleboro this morning. We'll go from mystery to open phones, brewing, and then pottery during our travels this morning. Let's begin in my favorite section, literature. Sarah Storr Taylor, by my count, is on to her third series and just released her third book in that series. After her Sweeney St. George book, she had a YA series that I'm a massive fan of, The Expeditioners. Now it's the Maggie Darcy series, which is also making me, or almost making me, forget the kids in the previous set of books. The new Maggie Darcy mystery is The Drowning Sea, and it's published by Minotaur Books. And joining me now to discuss her latest is author Sarah Storr Taylor. Sarah, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's so great to be back. I love being on your show.
It's great having you, and it's great having you solo, so I don't have to refer to you as SST to differentiate you from another Sarah. Listeners, to ask Sarah about the latest in the Maggie Darcy series, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sarah, for those who haven't had the pleasure of meeting Maggie Darcy yet, please introduce her to our listeners.
Sure. So Maggie is a 40-something Long Island homicide detective. And when we first meet her in the first book in the series, The Mountains Wild, Maggie is she's the divorced mother of a teenage daughter, and she's really, you know, doing great at her job as a homicide detective on Long Island. And then she gets a call that new evidence has been found in a case that has always haunted her, the disappearance of her beloved cousin Aaron in Ireland 23 years before. And the book sort of goes back and forth between the period in 1993 where Aaron goes missing and Maggie first goes to Ireland to see if she can find her, and ultimately isn't successful then, and then the contemporary period where new evidence is found and Maggie returns to Ireland to see if she can solve this case once and for all. And I won't tell you how it ends, but
good job.
I can tell you that she has some connections in Ireland now that bring her back in the second and in the third book, The Drowning Sea, where she's actually spending the summer on a remote West Cork peninsula.
Yeah, and as The Drowning Sea opens, where is Maggie in her career, her love life, as a parent?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is one of the things that I love about
yes.
writing a series.
Yes.
You know, that I can follow her through all of these sort of life transitions and all these, you know, different cases, of course. And so at the beginning of The Drowning Sea, Maggie has she's left her career on Long Island behind. The events of the second book, A Distant Grave, have kind of blown up her career on Long Island and her life on Long Island in a lot of ways. And she's thinking about moving to Ireland to be with the man she loves, who's an Irishman. And so she and her daughter are spending the summer with her boyfriend and his son to kind of see if they can make this work, to see if they can be a family, and she's kind of exploring her career options in Ireland.
Yeah, Connor, by the way, Connor is the boyfriend there in Ireland. Whenever we think of Ireland, we think of this welcoming place with rolling green hills and shimmering lakes, but the setting for The Drowning Sea is a bit more foreboding. Tell us about Rosshead and Rosscliffe House.
Yes. So the Rosshead is a fictional peninsula that I made up, but very much inspired by some of the actual peninsulas there on the West Cork coast, where I've spent time. And It's a beautiful, but as you say, sort of foreboding. They're high cliffs, and of course the cliffs are quite dangerous if you happen to step the wrong way, as some unfortunate victims do in this book. And or perhaps they didn't step the wrong way. Perhaps they were pushed. And it's there's an old Anglo-Irish house on the peninsula, and the history of this house is quite complicated and quite dark in many ways. And when Maggie arrives on the peninsula, the house has been abandoned for many years. It was once the home of a famous Irish artist. But some locals are trying to get the planning permission to turn it into a hotel. And there's a lot of tension and sort of angst about that on the peninsula and in the village where Maggie and Connor are spending the summer. And so she kind of comes into this situation where, you know, history is reasserting itself, and there are those who want to protect the peninsula and not develop it, and those who do want to develop it, and it's all a big stew of of complicated emotions that kind of sets the stage for murder.
Yeah, it does. And I really pay much attention to a book's cover after that initial glance that, you know, might get me to pick it up. But in this case, with this book, I must have studied it 20 times, Sarah, as I made my way through the book. I kept, you know, picking up the cover and looking at it, you know, as I would finish a chapter and try to get a better understanding of this place, right? So describe what we see there.
So, so, you know, there are these very, very high cliffs, and anyone who's been to Ireland, you know, and has visited any of, you know, the famous ones are, of course, the cliffs of Moher on the west coast, but there are other parts of Ireland where there are also high cliffs, and you know, just the beautiful natural landscape, unspoiled in many places, the sea below, and you know, as you said, I think the sort of iconic Irish scene of green fields rolling down to these high cliffs, and then. You know, on the cover of the book, there's sort of a, the cover of the book actually nods more to the older history of this peninsula where there was a Norman castle. But in the book, the Norman castle is sort of in ruins, and there's this foreboding Anglo-Irish, manor house, a large, what in Ireland is called the big house, where the Anglo-Irish landlord would have lived back in the day.
Yeah. And let's talk about the cliffs in Ireland. You kind of just touched on that. But when I was in Ireland, I went to the cliffs of Moher. I drove up to Maidenhead and Hornhead up in Donegal, right?
And, Yeah,
and like you can walk up to these cliffs – with no barriers. If Ireland was America, you know, they'd be blocked off. You'd have to, you could only get within maybe 60 yards of the cliffs or something without wearing like a tether or a bungee or something. But there, these cliffs, right, there's no barriers. And you look down 600 feet or so to the sea. So what is it like? This really sets up what's happening in this book. You know, how is it walking out there on dark, windy nights along Ross Cliff?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this sense of, you know, that you have to have some personal responsibility because you're right. There aren't any guardrails or fences. That's something that when I was researching this book, I spent some time in West Cork, and I went for a lot of walks out on the cliffs, very much like the ones that I invent for this book. And you really have to be aware of the wind, obviously, and in a storm, it would be very, very easy to step, you know, to take a wrong step and go over. And so, you know, you have to be careful. I remember asking a farmer who grazed his cows on a field right on the cliffs there. You know, I said, how do you make sure that you don't, you know, that they don't go over?
Right.
And he said, oh, you know, every year or so you might lose a cow, but mostly they figured it out. And, I think that, you know, I think that's right. I think people are just very aware and are careful about where they walk. But of course it's a great setting for a murder mystery.
Yeah. And describe, the people and the land of West Cork.
Yeah. So West Cork is one of my favorite regions of Ireland. And, there's a lot of very old history there, of course. There were some famous kings of Ireland who were from West Cork. And, during the War for Independence, there was a lot of important history that happened in West Cork. So, you know, some very, important battles, fights that happened there. And it's also where my family comes from, where my Irish ancestry lies. And so when I was researching the book, it was really meaningful to go to, I found kind of a handful of what are called townlands, which are kind of the smallest municipal designation, even smaller than a village. And I found the places where my ancestors lived before they emigrated. And West Cork is very it's rugged in places, mm-hmm. and in other places it's extremely beautiful and kind of gentle. It's a varied landscape. But the thing that I found so evocative, I think, is these peninsulas on the west coast.
Yeah,
and these
absolutely
wonderful little villages, where you can walk out on the peninsulas all day and then find a pub with a fire and music and
some fish chowder. Yeah.
Exactly.
And as I traveled around Ireland, it was interesting when you'd say you were headed to Cork and they said, oh, Cork, they're the loveliest people in Cork. Yeah, they are. And,
well, and people from Cork really believe that they are the most important part of Ireland. I mean, there's kind of there's a real joke about how, people who are from Cork really believe that it's Ireland's first city, not Dublin. It's Cork, it's Cork.
Yeah, yeah. I get that. All right, Sarah, I did a lot of preamble because I love hearing you talk about the setting of this book, but now it's time. Tell us about the story that unfolds in The Drowning Sea.
Sure. So Maggie, when the summer begins, Maggie and her daughter are pretty traumatized from the events of the first two books in the series.
Yeah.
And Maggie is in particular very worried about her daughter. And when a body is found below the cliffs, she is, concerned. And she wants to know more about what's happening so that she can kind of prepare her daughter and figure out how to talk to her daughter about this. And it turns out that the body is that of a local builder, someone who was working on the development projects on this peninsula. And he was a young man from Poland who had disappeared a few months before. It was assumed he'd just gone home to Poland, but in fact his body has been found. And Maggie, she has this sort of anxiety about what's happening, and that anxiety only grows when her daughter Lily starts dating a boy who was friends with the victim. And so she, even though she's not working as a police officer in Ireland yet, she becomes involved in this case, and she starts asking questions, and she starts looking around to try to keep her daughter safe. And then her landlady, who, as it turns out, is the daughter of the Irish artist who lived in the Anglo-Irish manor house that I was describing, asks her to help out with a historical mystery. And so she's sort of, she's looking to the past, and she's also very much in the present trying to keep her daughter safe. And I liked the idea of having her, Maggie is someone who has been on so many official homicide investigations.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the idea of having her be a little bit of an amateur sleuth in this book and have to kind of, you know, work around the official investigation a bit to find out what she needs to know.
You could just feel her jonesing to get involved. I mean, it's her police detective instinct, right, to try to solve something like this. And the other part of it is, as you mentioned, her mothering instinct to try to protect her child and want to know what's going on. So those things are at work. And it's almost like a relief when the landlord neighbor says, hey, I'd like you to do some investigating. You could just feel Maggie get really amped up, like, all right, I'm in.
Right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's something she's coming to terms with in this book,
yeah.
You know, that this is who she is, and she doesn't feel fulfilled, you know, mm-hmm. Unless she's investigating.
Yeah. Now, what's happening now at Ross Head has tendrils that reach back to, I think it's 2013, when there was a little offshore activity. So what happened then?
Yeah, so this is actually, you know, taken from real life. There have been quite a few, you know, fairly high-profile drug seizures off the coast of West Cork. And, you know, if you look at a map, you can understand why, that if you're trying to bring illegal goods of any kind, but in particular drugs, into Europe, that coast of Ireland is the logical place to do it, because, you know, you can come from North America, South America, and Ireland as part of the EU is sort of a direct avenue to that European market. And so, you know, there have been some, probably many that weren't caught, but there have been a lot of traffickers who have been caught. And there was one kind of famous one that got a lot of coverage where the boat sank and the traffickers had to be rescued by the authorities who had been, you know, tracking them and following them. There had been sort of an EU joint task force. And so I was, you know, I was kind of intrigued by that, by that history and by some of these cases. And so that comes into play in this book as well.
Yeah. How did that, the drug drop in the book, impact this wee Irish village, Ross Head?
Yeah. So, you know, Maggie starts to learn about this when the police presence that arrives in Ross Head after the body is found is, you know, a bit more than normal. She's sort of aware that there are drugs enforcement officers and some people who might not be there otherwise. And so she starts to look into this part of the village's history. And, you know, there are people in Rosscliffe who may or may not be involved, and she has to kind of figure out how and why and who and what it might have to do with these suspicious deaths.
Now, I've noted this before, that you do capture the lilt and the vocabulary, the pacing of the Irish quite well in your dialogue. And that's not always easy to do without sounding, you know, kind of too trite when you're not Irish. So where did you absorb that, and how careful are you with writing that dialogue in that manner?
Yeah. So first of all, thank you. 'Cause that's one of the, you know, it's one of the things that I really want to do.
Yeah.
And one of the things I really don't want to do is represent, Irish English in a way that sounds stereotypical,
right.
You know,
yeah.
The sort of, you know, bagosh and bagora speech patterns that you often see in books written by people who, you know, who haven't actually spent any time in Ireland. And so, when I lived in Ireland, I lived in Dublin, and so I was exposed to one very, you know, regional way of speaking Hiberno English. But, you know, of course, like any place, there each region has its own sort of flavor and its own colloquialisms and slang. And,
mm-hmm.
and so part of my research is always kind of being in touch with that. And so having spent some time in West Cork. I really tried to you know, spend a lot of time with that, with the way that people in specifically in West Cork speak. And I also, you know, I also think it's really important to kind of be aware of how people's speech patterns are changing. You know, in parts of Dublin, it's really interesting. My Irish friends tell me, and I've experienced this, that in parts of Dublin, you know, people, younger people especially, almost speak with a North American accent because of their exposure to television and popular culture. And then in other parts of Ireland, you still have a you know, what you would think of as a much more traditional accent and use of slang and colloquialism. And so I think that's part of it, is just, you know, being aware of the diversity and the different ways people speak. And of course, Ireland has had much more in-migration from countries in Europe and from countries around the world now. And so that, you know, just as in America, immigration changes the way that people speak. And so, I think it's just sort of researching and talking to people and being aware of all of those things.
Sarah, we've got about 30 seconds left. I believe Sweeney St. George lasted 4 books, The Expeditioners 3. I'm going to guess we're going to get at least 4 from Maggie Darcy. I feel this real forward momentum when I read this book. So don't make me beg. We will have a 4th book at least from Maggie, right?
Yes, I've written it, and I'm revising it right now, so it'll be out. In fact, I even have a pub date. It comes out June 20th of 2023. So,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, and I hope many more.
I think it has great legs, and I hope you don't get bored, or you know, can continue to find wonderful adventures for her. Sarah Stuart Taylor is the author of the Maggie Darcy mysteries. Her latest is The Drowning Sea. It's published by Minotaur Books. Sarah, it's always great having you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rick. I always love talking to you.
Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're open up the phones again. And I'm coming up today at 1 o'clock, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by 120 minutes of music with gracious Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
Hey, we're back on Vermont Viewpoint, and we're doing it again, opening those phones for your enjoyment. Or in the case of Fred, telling me which host of this show you like better than me. You can do that. Go right ahead. I've got thick skin. 802-244-1777. 877-291-8255. Email is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Let's hear about celebs that you've met who were really down to earth and whose company you enjoyed. You can also let us know about someone who was kind of a jerk. Ooh, I've got a couple of those. Well, one in particular. We've got our house band, Bill LaBeouf and the Bold Vikings, back on it, playing open phone music for you every day now. This morning, they're reaching back to 1981, covering Tommy Two Tone's 867-5309, Jenny. That's Tommy Two Tone, not to be confused with actor Tommy Tune, right? And what's funny is 867-5309, in the town I grew up in, 867 was an exchange, you know, a prefix. So that was a Bethlehem, Pennsylvania number, if you wanted to call it. Okay, and yesterday, on the way home, I stopped in at Conant's farm to get some of their amazing corn. The variety they have right now is called Serendipity, and it's fabulous. So last night for dinner, 2 ears of corn, Vermont Creamery butter, and then a salad of Pomacala Farms onions, Savage Farms heirloom tomatoes and cucumbers. All Vermont. Some olive oil, balsamic vinegar, salt and pepper. Mm. So any outstanding veg dishes or recipes you'd like to share? What does your garden produce for you this summer? Let us know. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Oh, Karen, we have not heard from you in a while. Karen from Hardwick, how are you?
Good. I'm just wondering if anybody's talked to Roger about what we might expect from the winter. Are we going to have enormous amounts of snow to make up for our drought?
Ah, that's a great question. And I don't know when he can really kind of forecast that, but he does usually have a sense of it. So let me reach out. And, Karen, maybe next week, if Roger is up for it and can give us some predictions, maybe I'll have him on for a half hour. And we'll do a show on that. That's a great idea.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. All right, Karen in Hardwick, always great hearing from her. We head now to the Duke of Newbury, the Duke without portfolio, Your Grace, Fred.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, you got this thing down pat.
I'm on your payroll now, so I better get it right.
Hey, you know, payroll.
Yeah.
I was, they say that currency goes a long way.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm standing in line, and there's a fellow behind me, and he's got about three or four items, and I got a basket full.
Yep.
So I say to the guy, hey, look, why don't you get in front of me?
Yep.
And so he says, oh, great, huh? You know? And so then we carry on this conversation. And he says, he told me that his name was, and I can't remember. And then I told him that my name was Fred, and I live in Newbury. He looked at me, and he said, what? And I said, yeah, Fred, I live in Newbury. He says, I listen to your show all the time.
It has happened. This has happened. This show has become the Fred from Newbury show. You've taken control.
It's the Rick and Fred from Newberry show.
Oh my gosh! Did he address you as Your Grace? Because if so,
no, he didn't. He really didn't do that. No. I thought he was gonna, but he didn't. Oh, God, I can't get over this. This is crazy.
Fred, I love that so much that you have become a celebrity in your own right for your years of calling into this show. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
I love it. It's the Rick. You know, you've got to have the top headline.
Oh, the Rick and Fred show.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking that possibly – we could go on, Siri Radio?
Oh, Sirius, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We could have the big show on Sirius Radio. We could do it the Rick and Fred show on Sirius. And then, you know, the beauty of that, we could use four-letter words. We could get carried away.
Do you think I ever swear? You know, I'm a really pious person, Fred.
No. No, you know. I hate to say this.
Go ahead.
I hate to say this.
Go ahead.
So here's what happened. When I was in the military, I had to take a test because I wanted to go to a specialty school.
Yeah.
And it was a personality test. And the question that stuck out and drove me nuts was, which word describes you best, a liar, a cheat, or a thief? I thought about it for 1 minute, and I said, I know what the answer is. I'm a liar. Now the question is, are you as pure as Jesus Christ and never lied in your life?
I rarely, if ever, lie. I'll tell you why. I'm one of those rare people who don't have a guilt chip. And so I don't really care if I've done something. I don't care to hide it or to lie about it. So lying is not in my nature. Cheating, and stealing, I don't want, anything that somebody else has, right? That's yours. I'd prefer people not to take what I have. But I will give you, something if it'll, if it will bring you more pleasure than it does me, I'd be happy to give you a possession of mine. So of those three, cheating, you know, cheating in small ways would probably be, you know, I play the angles a little bit. So I'd say I'm a cheat more than I'm a liar or a thief.
Yeah, but the problem is, you know, you have to lie more than you cheat and steal. You steal less than you lie. I mean, you cheat less than you lie. Lying is something that humans do naturally.
Mm. Well, most humans.
Except you.
I don't really care what people
care,
think.
That means you lie. If you don't care, then you lie.
Oh, I'm not sure I'm following your logic. I feel like I'm up against a lawyer.
If you don't care whether you're a liar, a cheater, a thief, then
you're a liar.
You could be all three.
Fred, you're really sounding like a trial attorney. What was your career? I assume you're retired now. What was your career?
I'll tell you what my career was. My career was this. I graduated in the lower half of the upper third of my class. I flunked out of an agricultural school.
Uh-huh.
But then I decided to go to Wikipedia College and got a degree in current events. And then I went to Google University and got a master's degree in current events.
Well, evasive. They should have said evasiveness would have been the fourth option, and that's what Fred.
You know, that could very well be.
Yeah.
We're all evasive.
We are all evasive in some ways. I agree with that. All right.
Enough is enough, huh?
Yeah. Fred, thanks for calling. We're going to get the t-shirts made, the Rick and Fred show, to roll
there
out
with
the launch of our show. I'm not sure anyone could stand to listen, but we'll see what happens. Thanks, Fred. Always great hearing from you. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Well, the wheels have fallen off. Fred and I are going to be on a show together. The phones are seriously open, though. We're talking about, we can talk about music, good or bad celebrities you've met in person. What else? Veggies from the garden or any other recipes you'd care to tempt me with. You know I love noodling around the kitchen, so share away. I always love getting a recipe from a listener and trying it. By the way, tomorrow I am broadcasting live from the Madsonian Museum in Waitsfield, and we're going to discuss ideas about town planning and architecture, including net zero homes, as Vermont becomes a popular destination for out-of-state transplants, and for good reasons. People have found that this is a caring, safe place where people kind of work together, and we need to increase housing stock. So we're kind of we'll take a look at what that might look like as we absorb more. Now, remember, the governor has talked about this for a number of years, that we are an aging state, and he would like to have an influx of new and younger people to come here to serve as employees. We do have a shortage in staffing. And so if initiatives and if things like the pandemic happen, there are people who are called, I think, climate nomads, who are worried about climate change and find this to be, again, a safer place in that regard. We are going to see numbers jump like we've seen just in the last year and a half of our population. So how do we keep the Vermont, the Vermontness, that nature that we love here so much, and again, the sense of community, and yet grow to what number? 675,000, 700,000? Are we going to see a spurt like we've seen in certain parts of our history in the past? All right. Our numbers are 802-244-1777 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I talked about celebrities. We heard from a listener yesterday when I asked this, and she said that one of the nicest celebrities she's ever met is Bill Lee, former pitcher for the Red Sox and Expos, who is now Vermont's own Bill Lee, living in Craftsbury Common. And he is that. I can spot him on the street and just grab him and introduce him to, you know, friends who I'm with. And he's just as gregarious and lovely as any human being you've ever met. Brilliant guy, too. Really smart. One person who, and I don't like to trash people, right? I mean, celebrities have a lot of demands on their time and, you know, and they probably get tired of people walking up to them and saying, oh, aren't you Fred from Newbury? Oh my gosh, right? happens to Fred all the time. But the one person, that I had to deal with, and I was working at this polo club down in Florida. I mentioned this yesterday, and we'd have celebrities come in and, request from media to interview them. And one was Judd Hirsch from Taxi. And this is kind of funny because I think yesterday I mentioned how Mary Lou Henner, who played Nardo on Taxi, was about the loveliest, celebrity I ever met. Well, Judd Hirsch was quite the opposite. And, there was an interview request. And first of all, we couldn't just pick up the phone and call Judd, who was staying, oh, I don't know, 300-400, you know, yards away from our office. We had to call New York City to find out, to arrange to have him be interviewed. And then they would call Judd, and then they'd call, you know, us back. And he wanted a private and secure location. Now, this was a gated community. It was private already. And we had to clear the swimming pool area, which had hedges all around it, so that this interview could be conducted, in private. And, the dichotomy was Cleavon Little, they were performing at a local, theater. It was, Burt Reynolds Dinner Theater. Burt Reynolds had a dinner theater down in Florida, and Cleavon Little and, Judd Hirsch were in I'm Not Rappaport. And Cleavon Little, was just the opposite. He was all over the property playing tennis with people and golf and, at dinner, people would come over and chat him up, and he was just lovely. Anyway, sorry to rain on old Judd Hirsch, but, he was not the nicest of people. There was a time at a polo match when, and let me give the numbers again, because remember, if you don't call, I prattle on. That's the rule. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Sissy Spacek shows up, unannounced with her husband and children to a polo match. And what was very interesting was, so in Palm Beach, the whole society reporting was a big thing in some of the newspapers, you know, who showed up at what, who was with whom, was reported on. And so we had to hire a photographer for the polo matches, and then we had to hire a photographer for the society page. And Laura was our photographer, and she spotted Sissy Spacek, and she said, Rick, Sissy Spacek's up there. Okay, could you go up and ask her if it's all right if I photograph her? And so I had to sidle up in the row behind Sissy and her family, and I introduced myself to her, and I asked her, you know, what brought her to Palm Beach Polo today, and she said, to watch polo. Yes, of course. That's why you're at a polo match. And I said, would it be all right if we took some photographs, our photographer, for the society page? And she said, we're here to watch polo. And I took that as a no. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. And so she wasn't mean. She wasn't belligerent. Sometimes people like to have, you know, celebrities do like to have a little bit of cushion, a place where they can go without being bothered by people like me. And so I got the message. But there are many beautiful people. I've met Arnold Palmer and Chichi Rodriguez, two golfers, who, you know, in their later days, after wonderful careers, and they couldn't have been nicer individuals. You know, they just still had a sense of, being who they were. All right. Let's try to squeeze in a call. We got Josh joining us from Facetown. Josh, what's going on?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
Good. So, just talking about celebrity sightings.
Yeah.
I took a gap year, between high school and college back in the '80s, and, had the opportunity to live down in the Caribbean. I was teaching in a high school in the Windward Islands, and it was Christmas morning, 1984, and went over to this little island called Mustique, and we were sitting in a bar about 11:30, almost lunchtime, and I look over and I go, oh my goodness, that's Mick Jagger and Jerry Hall.
Wow.
And so I was like, you know, all right, you know, I was 18 years old. I'm like, you got to do it. You don't have this opportunity. So I walked over. They were sitting in a booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, hey, Mick, big fan. Just want to say hi. Merry Christmas. And he goes, oh, have a seat. And I'm like, okay. So I sat down. We just chit-chatted. He asked me what I was doing, and I told him about it. But couldn't have been nicer. Had a beer with Mick Jagger, 1984, Christmas Day.
Oh, Merry Christmas. How great is that, Josh? What's funny is that's so funny because two listeners have said they'd rather meet me than Mick Jagger. But now I think they're going to change their vote. I think it's going to be 3 votes for Mick Jagger, 0 for Rick Singeri. Josh, that's a great story. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. All right. Oops, Danny, it looks like they're flickering the lights as a sign that we need to put an end to the Open Phone Fest. Thanks to those who called this morning. We'll see what we can do again, I think, maybe Friday. We're going to take a break. CBS News is up next. Then we'll meet the founder of Switchback Brewing. Sox home again tonight, 6:10. Our broadcast starts 7:10, first pitch against the Blue Jays. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Back in the early days of Switchback Brewing, I had a friend who had a cardinal rule. And it had to do with restaurants. If the restaurant had Switchback on draft, the establishment immediately had cred. Her theory was that if they had taken such care in selecting the beers they offered, the food was probably also of a higher caliber. And she was right. Keep in mind, this was at a time when you didn't have many, if any, places offering a curated beer list of several dozen. Switchback has come a long way since they opened 20 years ago. Joining me now is the founder and brewmaster, Bill Cherry. Bill, it's an honor to have you on the show. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Good. Listeners, if you'd like to chat with Bill about beer, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Bill, when did you personally start brewing?
Boy, I started, you're going to make me show my age.
Okay.
The late 80s
uh-huh.
is when I started home brewing. And it was a different time even for home brewing back then. You couldn't get ingredients and stuff. You had to really hunt it down.
Yeah, there were like there was like a kit or something you could purchase, I think, back then. There was one like with a bag that you let stuff just brew. But what kind of beers did you enjoy creating originally?
You know, I'm remembering, and this also shows one of those things that we just called it dark beer.
Yeah.
And we didn't even know,
sure.
know about much stuff. And, you know, that was what they would talk about, but kind of a mimicking of the old Michelob Dark. was mine. And I thought that was, I was being very inventive to even go down that route. But and like a lot of things with homebrewers, when you do the darker beers, they usually taste a little better because they hide a little bit of your mistakes.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I thought I was very clever. I used to order, you know, a beer that I would have to, that was chewy, that I couldn't see through. You know, the darker the better back then, because that usually was where you'd find the most flavor, unfortunately. Where did the idea for that original wonderful switchback ale come from?
You know, that was something that percolated in my head for a couple of years, and it's always it's a hard story to tell to folks, but if you can imagine, I started thinking about how I thought so all the beers had been made that could be made. You know, it was so hard to find something new, and we're talking 20 years ago, and you look at it now, and apparently I was not very imaginative, but and I looked at it and I said, you know, what would I make if I started a brewery? What would I make that would be unique? And it slowly over the course of a couple of years started coming to me. And my favorite thing to talk about is that some of what switchback ale is comes from beers I don't like. And it was beers out in, and it was nowhere near here. It was out in the West Coast. There was a really popular beer at the time. And I just didn't care for it. And it made me think about, it's like, why do people like this so much? And I thought it was certain characteristics about the way it finished and the mouthfeel and stuff, even though I didn't like the flavor actually. And so I started incorporating that into, like, oh, you know what? You don't have to make it taste like that, but what if you capture that really good part about it?
Wow.
And I kind of created from there this thing that I felt like, I don't think anybody's making a beer that is quite like this.
And Bill, the finishing and the mouthfeel, you know, whenever I talk to brewers, you know, they'll cite that. How do you make that happen in what you put into your beer as you're brewing it?
Well, that's obviously the fun.
Yeah.
And the brewer's art. And even like with the original ale, I would say I was so scared of failing that, I pulled every trick in the book out that I knew and, probably did 50 unique things in that beer, of which, you know, three or four of them are important, but I don't know which ones they are. So we still do all 50 of them 20 years later. But it's a lot to do with, I've always invested, kind of I come from the side of brewing, right? I was a trained brewmaster and told my business partner, if we do this thing, we have to, you know, I want to do it the way a brewmaster would do it. I want to build a brew that way. So our equipment is always top notch and gives me the ability to really manipulate things. And that's where you get kind of wonky, but the switchback ale, the mashing, what we call where we're heating up the grains and steeping them in water and stuff, is really quite complex. And what that's doing is that's drawing flavors out. That's kind of a very German thing.
Yep.
Where they can take, you know, only one grain that only, you know, and pull different flavors out of it by just treating it differently, holding it at different temperatures and different thicknesses and stuff. And we do a little bit of that, even though switchback ale has, you know, like six or seven flavored grains in it to create all that redness and that interesting character. But so that's a thing I did a lot of, which was borrowing. So I borrowed from the Belgians and I borrowed from the Germans and I borrowed from American craft brewers all these ideas, and then created my little Frankenstein beer.
I'd love for someone new to come and say, I think we should cut out this step of the 50, and you'd say, oh, we can't do that. They'd say, why? And you'd say, I don't know, but we can't. It was exactly. Was it only kegs to start with? Am I right about that?
10 years we did nothing but keg beer.
Wow. So Bill, who was the first bar or restaurant to start serving it? I mean, and did it take much convincing?
Well, it did take a bit of convincing, and they gave us, they wouldn't commit to a real beer line. They gave us a line, a secondary line that they had been running cider through. And but we know it because we declared this, I declared this our official anniversary date. So it was Ake's Place in downtown Burlington.
Oh, yeah.
On October 22nd of 2002.
Oh,
that
my
first
gosh.
First pint. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, well done to Ake's Place for, we'll call them visionaries, even though you had to use a cider line. And then
that was a big deal back then when we graduated to the real beer stand.
Yeah. Well, 10 years of just being on draft, you know, so when did things happen? When did you broaden the product line? When did you start to bottle?
Yeah. So, I think it was 2005. The next beer we made was Roasted Red Ale. That was a, passion project for me, all built around a brand new hop called Amarillo, which is to this day a very popular IPA hop. And I had recognized that as a new variety, and it didn't work for Switchback Ale, but I was like, I'm going to make a beer around that. And we moved down to Dooley's Porter after that, which was after the very first employee I ever hired. And it was the style of beer he got to pick, but that he wanted. And, finally in 2012, we did the bottling, and that was by design, not necessarily the 10 years, but I always wanted to wait. And this is a theme for me, wanted to wait long enough to be able to purchase, really good packaging equipment, because the only thing that you can do to beer after you've got it in your cellaring tank and it's perfect is make it worse. Mm. And one of the ways you do that is by, you know, running it through inferior equipment and stuff. And so I'd always hope that when we made the move, we would do it. And we did.
Wow. Yeah. Boy, good call. Bill, you have expanded into this world of smoked beers, which is an altogether new category. Explain how someone smokes a beer.
The smoke comes from smoked malt. And this is fascinating to me is, prior to 1840, pretty much any beer you drank would have tasted smoky because they didn't have the technology to dry the grain without just passing, you know, hot air from a fire through the grain. And they figured it out in 1840 and started getting the non-smoke beer. So they're still in Bamberg, Germany, is the last place on earth where they still celebrate this old technique. And we can buy grains, malts that have been smoked from them. And when you brew with it, it tastes smoky.
Yeah. How do you balance that flavor and still maintain, you know, the taste of the beer itself so it doesn't get just masked by smoke?
And that's an interesting question in that you really are making some adjustments. So for instance, the two German beers that are is a German Helles, which is a light beer, and then a German Märzen, which is kind of a darker Oktoberfest style beer. And what the Germans will tell you is the light beer, they put almost no smoke character into it. In fact, one of them that is world famous makes the statement that their equipment has and their yeast has so much residual smoke that they don't need to even use smoke grain to get smoke flavor into a light beer. But then on the darker beers, you can load it up because there's a lot more going on. And so it's all about that interplay. And that's really what I've done with this is we looked at that, and I think you can appreciate this, is the things that, especially American craft brewers have done with introducing people to the IPAs and then taking IPAs into something that is not historical anymore. It's just expanded to such unusual things, followed by barrel conditioning and sours and introducing all these concepts. And I looked at smoke the same way. It's like, this is an old world style beer, But do we have to only make old world styles? Maybe we can expand that. And that's what we've done is we've got a dozen beers now. Things like smoked oyster stout.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Where we take the smoke and right to your point, it's all about how do I balance these flavors so that smoke becomes a complement to it rather than just the dominant, like, factor in the beer.
Yep.
and really make it a more interesting beer.
I want to talk about one of my favorites. So as a lead-in, tell us about this double IPA Cat series.
The Cats.
Yeah.
So this all came from our original, which is Octane Cat.
Yes.
And I realized when we were making Octane Cat, I realized right away we had heard of a new hop called Galaxy. And all of a sudden, just the name itself, I said, wait a minute. If we do a double IPA and we feature Galaxy Hop, now we've got Galaxy Cat. And I could already see the drawing of a cat in space. And we had so much fun with that. And it all came about from our brewer who develops new beer fairly flavors for us, along with myself, Morgan. She just took it upon herself, and I said, go for it. She wanted to try to make a double IPA without adding any just plain sugar. So it's the common way of getting that higher alcohol level is to add just pure sugar because it doesn't keeps the body light and it increases the alcohol. And she wanted to take on that challenge. And as I said before on my theme of we've got the equipment to be able to kind of really do these very interesting mashing techniques. And she came through and brought that to me. And I think I had the same reaction that you did, which is I took a drink of her testing and I was like, we've got to sell this to people
because this
like it really works. And it finishes so nice and clean and gentle and really packs that IPA punch.
At the break, Danny McGivergan, our director, and I were chatting. He said, oh, that one in the orange can. I said, oh, yeah, Octane Cat? Yes, that is near perfection, Bill. I love it so much. Why do I also, though, love Karsten so much?
Karsten is classic brewer's love.
Yeah.
How's that?
Yeah.
So it's a very long-aged a lager, very traditionally made in old techniques for German techniques to, I mentioned this before, draw flavors out of a single grain. And we just manipulate it and draw that out. And then for me, being a microbiologist at my core, we borrowed the lager yeast from the Augustiner monastery. And it's a very difficult, we found it to be a very difficult yeast to work with, but that's kind of what I like to do. And so I call it having a conversation. And it took probably a couple of years of me just like working with the yeast to see what do you want in your life? What do you like? Because I would like you to do this, but you keep wanting to do this. And you just kind of chat with each other, so to speak. And until it became happy and really carries that character. And that's really the secret to a great lager is having that persnickety lager yeast in its happy zone.
Oh, it's happy. Who's Karsten?
Karsten is one of the German technicians that disassembled and prepared for shipping our copper brew house that we make from 1964. We pulled it out of a brewery in a small town in Germany, and Karsten was one of the fellows. And we literally, when we were developing the brand, internally we had two versions of Karsten, and they were named after two of the guys that brought the copper tanks over, two of the German fellows, and Karsten won.
Oh, beautiful. A new ownership model was created several years ago at Switchback, became 100% employee-owned. So why did you make that decision to do that?
That came from me realizing that I was getting older and that one of my nightmares scenarios was watching, you know, this baby I built just kind of, you know, at the end of it, me just kind of selling it to some, to anybody.
Yeah.
And I used to joke saying I would probably have to leave the state because I would be watching them making these changes that I may not care for on my brand. And who better to carry it on is the staff that has actually made this whole thing possible. So it works out that when you go with an ESOP, you know, I get to keep working, which I wanted to keep working, but I already know where the brewery is going to be sold to. It's going to be sold to the exact people I would like it sold to. And so we're all working together with them slowly. What it happens is they're slowly buying me out until I retire.
Gotcha.
And everybody loves it, you know, and you can tell they know that their success and the more success we have, the better their retirement is, because when they leave the company, they own part of the company now and they get paid for that. And it's substantial. So it's a neat deal.
Yeah. Bill, we have about a minute left. So give me another, pour me another Switchback product that you want me to try.
Right now you got to go after Zabu. We say drink in the view with Zabu. very much a Switchback product. We're taking the IPA and moving it a little bit, just like I did with Switchback Ale. Zabu is rather than following some of the very tropical fruit sides, which has been done really, really well by so many people.
Sure.
Said, what can we go with? And so we've got like oranges and melons and stone fruits like peaches and pears in there. So it's still a really interesting New England fruity IPA, but it's got that separate character. So it's distinct and yet really, really enjoyable. And it has that Switchback finish where you just kind of, you finish your sip and you take the glass away and all of a sudden you're like, well, that was good, but I can't taste anymore. So I need to sip some more.
Oh, I love it. Bill Cherry is the founder and brewmaster of Switchback Brewing Company in Burlington, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. To learn more, you can visit switchbackvt.com. Bill, thanks for every can, bottle, and keg you've ever produced and for being on the show this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Take care, Bill. We're going to head to CBS News, and then it'll be on to Brattleboro to see the amazing creations of Laura Zindel Designs. And coming up at 11 this morning, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. So I'm paging through a magazine, and I see an ad for a shop called Addison West in Middlebury in Waitsfield. And zoinks, what is this? Truly stunning pottery, unlike any I've seen before. And wait for it, they're made here in Vermont. So I am gobsmacked. How do I not know this company? It's called Laura Zindel Design, based in Brattleboro. Well, now I do, and now I have Laura Zindel on the show with me. Laura, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Laura about her amazing pottery or to rub it in that you knew about her creations long before I did, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And if you want to see what Laura creates, you can visit Laura Zindel, that's Zindel.com as we're speaking. Laura, what got you started making pottery?
Well, I've been making pottery for as long as I can remember, and I think that somebody brought in a kick wheel into our grammar school when I was in third grade, and I begged to try it, and it was sort of like no looking back after that. I was hooked.
Oh, my.
And I went on in high school and continued making it there. We had a great art department in my high school that actually had a completely separate department for ceramics, if you can believe that.
Mm.
And the teacher there figured out a way to let all the pottery nerds kind of get out of after-school sports and do pottery instead. So it was sort of my everyday activity. And
what is it, Laura?
What
is it about creating these bowls and plates and tumblers that you enjoy?
Well, I think, you know, what I do now is sort of the culmination of drawing, which I also love to do,
mm-hmm.
and pottery. So when I sort of figured out a technique where I could take my illustrations and melt them to the surface of the pottery to sort of tell a story and use the pottery as a canvas, that's sort of when things also came together. And, you know, I could take the two things I liked the most and do them together. So that was the beginning of that.
Yeah, the illustrations, the artwork that adorns these pieces are absolutely stunning. Where do you draw the inspiration for these beautiful drawings?
Well, clearly nature is my inspiration. I loved sort of the technique of scientific illustrators and really doing everything in very highly detailed. Every creature, every plant has its own sort of magic, and I like to be able to tune into that and all the little details and the repetitions and patterns and you know, whether it's fur or feathers,
mm-hmm.
it's just always so filled with information to try to capture.
Yeah, there's flora and fauna captured on the pieces that Laura does. When did you first develop the pieces we see today that are part of the Laura Zindel design? You know, there's probably a long road from that third grade, you know, start to now. But when did this idea, this beautiful design, you know, itinerary you have now really happen?
I was probably in the late 90s. I was living in San Francisco, and sort of that was when I started selling my work and figuring out how to, you know, combine these elements together. So it's been a long, long time that it's developed into what it is today. But somewhere in the late 90s, around 97.
And is that when Laura Zindel Design started the company?
Not really. I mean, I sold my work at art fairs, like the Sausalito Art Fair, and I sold it directly to the public. And then eventually I moved to Vermont with my family, and we started selling to stores. And that's sort of when it became more of a business. It was never sort of an intentional, you know, where I sit down with a business plan and figured it all out.
Right.
I sort of followed the gingerbread crumbs to where I am now.
Mm. When did the Brattleboro store open up?
That came about in about 2013 when we moved into the space we're in now, which is in downtown Brattleboro. It's not sort of on the, you know, the main street of Main Street. You have to sort of search us out. But we have a very large studio where we make all the pieces, and then we have a showroom in the front where, you know, the public can come in and buy our work during the week.
And how, when did other aware retailers catch wind of the beauty you're creating there?
Well, when we started selling to stores, we also, of course, went to trade shows that were for retailers, and that is where you're, you know, I'm introduced, as well as they're introduced to us, to an enormous population of people who are interested in buying work specific to the type of store they have. And one of the first stores that started carrying our work was Barney's. I think one of the first trade shows we did, Barney signed us on to their New York City store, and that really sort of kicked us into gear.
Yeah.
And, you know, from there, we just sort of didn't look back. And now we have maybe, you know, hundreds of stores throughout the country that sell our work.
Oh, Laura, wow. What a kind of a great pat on the back to say, oh, I think we're onto something here. Barney's wants us. I have to ask about the first item that really grabbed me. I saw this and I could not stop staring at it. And these are the large bowls. And they not only have the wonderful design outside, but a surprise inside. Tell us about them, how you came up with this idea.
Well, you know, we wanted to make a collection of bowls. Everyone likes a nice bowl. It's, easy sell, a bowl, no matter what it is. And so when we designed them, you know, like I said, I like to have a lot of surface area to put these designs on. They're sort of like a big canvas. And a bowl has really a three-dimensional canvas where you can go up and over the rim, go around the foot. And so we sort of put a swash of color around the bottom to sort of ground something. You know, I like to think of all these animals in a context, so they sort of sit on that ground level to some degree. And because the glaze is transparent, and so are the images that I put over them, a little bit of the color could shine through on the bottom, and then we could take all those designs, sort of the flora, you know, the context of where they live, their environment, and sort of wrap that inside the bowls and maybe put an acorn in there at the bottom. So, you know, so you're looking at a completely three-dimensional piece from top to bottom.
I got to say, it's absolutely brilliant. And that subtle glazing color at the foot of the bowl just brings it all together. And, I was just blown away when I saw that first. And then that's just drew me in to see everything else that you do. You've got wonderful design collections from birds to polar life. What group is a personal favorite of yours?
Well, it's hard to say.
I know.
Picking a favorite child. But,
yeah.
You know, probably whatever I'm working on last is one of my favorites. So I also really love the sea life line we have, the coastal line.
Yep.
We sort of decided to do everything from, New England, Atlantic ocean waters to the Pacific waters and incorporate all of those different creatures and shells and all, and so that's one of my very favorites. All the woodland creatures are irresistible. Our customers really love birds. Everyone loves birds. So, you know, we've got a little bit of everything. We have a very eclectic group of customers, so we like to be able to offer something to everyone's interests. And
now, one group you didn't mention, and I love them, but I wonder, how well do these sell, are the insects? Because, you know, we love birds, we love some of the sea life. Insects, you know, I'm not so sure we love and want to see, on a plate or a bowl. So how well do the insect line do?
Well, you could say we sort of have the market cornered a little bit. So if you're in the market for a spider bowl, you know, you almost have to come to us. But, you know, go back to the Barney's connection, I started out only doing insects. That was the first thing we did. And
no
so,
kidding.
You know, they just thought it was fantastic and weird. And like you said, it's not for everybody, but you know, that was because it was our first introduction into that world. So they were very popular and continue to be so. I mean, not so much as maybe a bird, but we do still keep them in our collections.
Oh, that makes me so happy. And, Barney's truly visionary. Laura, tell us about some of the handmade items that you offer.
Well, we have a large range of platters and serving dishes. We make bases. We make bowls, obviously, we discussed, and cups. We kind of have it all for the table.
Mm-hmm.
And all the different products come with all the different collections on them in different ways so that you can sort of mix and match all of them. And all of those items are made here in our studio. So we make all of those from start to finish. And we also have a dinnerware line, which is serving plates. So we have dinner plates and salad plates and bowls that are a little bit more sturdy and for the microwave and dishwasher. And we partner with a manufacturer that makes all our blanks for us, and we decorate them here to order in the studio.
Mm. Now, penguins don't normally get the publicity that many other animals do, but your representation of them, they're literal and lovable at the same time. So how do you develop those drawings?
Well, before I started drawing, I do a lot of research. I collect a lot of photographs, and I look through a lot of books. And then I usually sort of piece them all together to get the viewpoint I want, or the different qualities that I want to showcase about each creature. So, it's sort of a long process, and then I start drawing, and then I create another the fauna part of it, so that they have a context to be in.
Mm-hmm. What is the reaction when someone steps into your Brattleboro shop and takes in all of those wonderful creations?
Well, usually people sort of just stop in their tracks.
Yeah.
The sheer amount of things that we offer. And I usually let them have a little time alone to absorb everything. And, after years of being in a very small booth selling our work also, I'm used to people's reactions. And, then they'll find their way in and figure out which of the creatures they're drawn to. And,
yeah.
People tell me personal stories about, why they like particular creatures, or a story they have with a family member or a friend.
Mm.
And so it's really wonderful. People find a very easy and quick connection to what we do.
Am I just making this up, or does drawn butter served in your lobster sauce dish or cocktail sauce in that shrimp version of the sauce dish taste better than it normally would present
it?
Any-
Absolutely. Everything tastes better in our dishes.
Right? There's just something that says, oh my gosh, you're going to love this 100 times more than if you just put it in some old dish, and melt it. Tell us about your home decor line.
Well, we do have some pieces that go on the wall. So I wanted to have something that people could hang up, like art. And so we have wall boxes. We call them boxes because they also are three-dimensional. They don't have a back part of the box, but it's something that you could set on your counter or a shelf, as well as hang it on the wall. And they're sort of a 6x6 square and have a full range of our designs that you can also sort of create your own collection. So you can, I love to put more than one together, 4, 8, and just keep going. Like you were going to have a whole wall of paintings, it's the same way. You can just kind of keep going and collect them all.
Mm. And again, you can see these at laurazindel.com as we're talking about them. Laura, has anyone ever told you that you can even make a warty gourd and a hedgehog look lovely?
Yeah, kind of like the spiders and snakes, I guess.
Right, but, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think they're all beautiful. And, like the warty gourd's a really good example of something that's just so very interesting. And even though people think it might be a little creepy, the more you look at it, the more you see all the beauty that's there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Boy, when you said spiders and snakes, I thought of the old Jim Stafford song, I Don't Like Spiders and Snakes. Do you remember that tune?
I do remember that song, absolutely.
Yeah, well, he didn't see your creations. That's all I can say. So how often are you working on, you know, new artwork, you know, and how often do you release new designs on your works?
Well, normally I'd be working on something all the time, and we'd introduce a new collection every year or every other year. The pandemic slowed us down a little bit because there just was less time for me to be able to do all that, the creative side of what we do here. But I'm getting back into it, so we should have a new collection out early next year. And I'm not going to reveal what the It's a spoiler.
Oh, Laura, you're tough. I thought for sure we'd have another exclusive here on this show, but I'll hold off. If it's narwhals, I'm going to be at your front door the day they get released, pushing people out of the way.
You're a narwhal man.
Oh, my God, am I ever.
Well, see, I'm sure there's a story behind that.
Why I'm a narwhal fan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because
there's always a story.
Yeah, because it's just so obscure. I love things that, you know, the rest of the world just aren't quite sure what to make of. So
they're just sort of magical. They almost look they're not real.
The unicorns of the sea. I know.
Exactly.
Yeah, the first time you see one, you think somebody just, it's like, oh, this is like a fantasy thing that you're talking about here. No, that's biology. Yeah.
Exactly.
Are there any items that you create that you want to make sure we mention that we haven't talked about yet?
No, I think we've talked about all the things we do. I mean, to really sort of get a sense of that, you'd have to go to the website and peruse it and go down the rabbit hole of all the different collections that we do.
Yeah.
The great thing about our website is that you can, if you just want to go on there and see hedgehogs, you can type that in and it'll just bring you straight to the, all the hedgehogs. You know, some people like to take it all in, but there's a lot to see. I'd love for people to be able to create their own stories. Mm. You know, we have people who will buy a different plate for every member of their family for a table for the holidays or whatever. You know, people who have tell me stories about their grandkids who come over and they have to eat off of their plate.
Yeah.
So I think it's fun because you can... You can a little bit for something for everybody.
They are heirloom quality. When is the store in Brattleboro open? When can people stop in and see you?
We are open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. Because it's part of our studio, we are closed on the weekends, but and for major holidays, we'll be closed. But anytime, and you can always call beforehand if you'd like a little tour of what we do. See the behind the scenes of how we make everything. We love to give people a tour.
Mm. Lauren Zindel is the owner of Laura Zindel Design in Brattleboro. And to learn more, go to laurazindel.com. Laura, it was wonderful having you on the show this morning. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. You can also subscribe to the podcast there. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow, but I'll be broadcasting live from the Madsonian Museum in Waitsfield. And we're going to discuss planning for growth in Vermont and discussing designing the homes of the future.